See if they go up the wall on the other side of the door. You trying to get rid of me? If possible, she laughed, breaking the tension. All right, I'll look on the other side of the door. When she was gone, Harry said, she's pretty worked up. Norman said, do you know the Ben Stone story? Which one? Beth did her graduate work in Stone's lab. Oh. Benjamin Stone was a biochemist at BU, a colorful, engaging man. Stone had a reputation as a good researcher who used his graduate students like lab assistants, taking their results as his own. In this exploitation of others' work, Stone was not unique in the academic community, but he proceeded a little more ruthlessly than his colleagues. Beth was living with him as well. Uh-huh. Back in the early 70s. Apparently she did a series of important experiments on the energetics of ciliary inclusion bodies. They had a big argument, and Stone broke off his relationship with her. She left the lab, and he published 5 papers, all her work, without her name on them. Very nice, Harry said. So now she lifts weights. Well, she feels mistreated, and I can see your point. Yeah, Harry said. But the thing is, lie down with dogs, get up with fleas, you know what I mean? Jesus, Beth said, returning. This is like the girl who's raped is always asking for it. Is that what you're saying? No, Harry said, still lifting up floor panels, following the wires. But sometimes you gotta ask what the girl is doing in a dark alley at 3 a.m. in a bad part of town. I was in love with him. It's still a bad part of town. I was 22 years old. How old do you have to be? Up yours, Harry. Harry shook his head. You find the wires, Butch? Yes, I found the wires. They go into some kind of a glass grid. Let's have a look, Norman said, going next door. He'd seen flight recorders before. They were long, rectangular metal boxes, reminiscent of safe deposit boxes, painted red or bright orange. If this was... He stopped. He was looking at a transparent glass cube, 1 foot on each side. Inside the cube was an intricate grid arrangement of fine, glowing blue lines. Between the glowing lines, blue lights flickered intermittently. There were 2 pressure gauges mounted on top of the cube, and 3 pistons, and there were a series of silver stripes and rectangles on the outer surface on the left side. It didn't look like anything he had seen before. Interesting. Harry peered into the cube. Some kind of optronic memory is my guess. We don't have anything like it. He touched the silver stripes on the outside. Not paint, it's some plastic material. Probably machine readable. By what? Certainly not us. No, probably a robot recovery device of some kind. And the pressure gauges? The cube is filled with some kind of gas under pressure. Maybe it contains biological components to attain that compactness. In any case, I'll bet this large glass is a memory device. A flight recorder? Their equivalent, yes. How do we access it? Watch this, Beth said, going back to the flight deck. She began pushing sections of the console, activating it. Don't tell Barnes, she said over her shoulder. How do you know where to press? I don't think it matters, he said. I think the console can sense where you are. The control panel keeps track of the pilot? Something like that. In front of them, a section of the console glowed, making a screen, yellow on black. RV-LHOOQ, DCOM-1, USS Star Voyager. Then nothing. Harry said, now we get the bad news. What bad news? Norman said. And he wondered, why had Harry stayed behind to look for the flight recorder instead of going with Ted and Barnes to explore the rest of the ship? Why was he so interested in the past history of this vessel? Maybe it won't be bad, Harry said. Why do you think it might be? Because, Harry said, if you consider it logically, something vitally important is missing from this ship. At that moment, the screen filled with columns. Ship systems, life systems, data systems, quartermaster, flight records, Core Operations, Deck Control, Integration, Direct, LSS Test 1.0, LSS Test 2.0, LSS Test 3.0, Propulsion Systems, Waste Manage, V9, Status OM2, Outer, Status OM3, Inner, Status OM4, Fore, Status DV7, Aft, Status V, Summa, Status Comrec 2, Line A9-11, Line A12-BX, Stabilix. What's your pleasure? Beth said, hands on the console. Flight records, Harry said. He bit his lip. Flight data summaries, RV-LH00Q, FDS-1143-1231-45, FDS-1146-1231-48, FDS-1149-1231-51, FDS-1152-1231-53, FDS-1154-1231-54, FDS-1155-631-55. FDS-7155-1231-55, FDS-1156-131-56, FDS-2156, Entry Event, FDS Entry Event, FDS Entry Event Summary, 8:06, OZ/010/odd-000/XXX/X. $S/XXX/X%(UP)(X(@X)(X)!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!!! Harry was peering at the screen. As you see, the earliest records are in 3-year intervals. Then they're shorter, 1 year. Then 6 months, and finally 1 month. Then this entry event business. So they were recording more and more carefully, Beth said, as the ship approached the entry event, whatever it was. I have a pretty good idea what it was, Harry said. I just can't believe that. Let's start. How about entry event summary? Beth pushed buttons. On the screen, a field of stars, and around the edges of the field, a lot of numbers. It was three-dimensional, giving the illusion of depth. Holographic? Not exactly, but similar. Several large magnitude stars there. Or planets. What planets? I don't know. This is one for Ted, Harry said. He may be able to identify the image. Let's go on. He touched the console. The screen changed. More stars. Yeah, and more numbers. The numbers around the edges of the screen were flickering, changing rapidly. The stars don't seem to be moving, but the numbers are changing. No, look, the stars are moving too. They could see that all the stars were moving away from the center of the screen, which was now black and empty. No stars in the center, and everything moving away, Harry said thoughtfully. The stars on the outside were moving very quickly, streaking outward. The black center was expanding. Why is it empty like that in the center, Harry? Beth said. I don't think it is empty. I can't see anything. No, but it's not empty. In just a minute we should see... There! A dense white cluster of stars suddenly appeared in the center of the screen. The cluster expanded as they watched. It was a strange effect, Norman thought. There was still a distinct black ring that expanded outward, with stars on the outside and on the inside. It felt as if they were flying through a giant black donut. My God, Harry said softly. Do you know what you are looking at? No, Beth said. What's that cluster of stars in the center? It's another universe. It's what? Well, okay, it's probably another universe. Or it might be a different region of our own universe. Nobody really knows for sure. What's the black donut? Norman said. It's not a donut. It's a black hole. What you are seeing is the recording made as this spacecraft went through a black hole and entered into another... Is someone calling? Harry turned, cocked his head. They fell silent but heard nothing. What do you mean, another universe?
Shh.
A short silence, and then a faint voice crying, "Hello!" "Who's that?" Norman said, straining to listen. The voice was so soft, but it sounded human, and maybe more than one voice. It was coming from somewhere inside the spacecraft. "Yoo-hoo! Anybody there? Hello?" "Oh, for God's sake," Beth said. "It's them on the monitor." She turned up the volume on the little monitor Edmonds had left behind. On the screen they saw Ted and Barnes standing in a room somewhere and shouting, "Hello! Hello!" "Can we talk back?" "Yes, press that button on the side." Norman said, "We hear you." "High damn time," Ted. "All right now," Barnes said. "Listen up."
"What are you people doing back there?"
Ted said. "Listen up," Barnes said. He stepped to one side, revealing a piece of multicolored equipment. "We now know what this ship is for."
"So do we," Harry said.
"We do," Beth and Norman said together. But Barnes wasn't listening. "And the ship seems to have picked up something on its travels."
"Picked up something? What is it?"
"I don't know," Barnes said. "But it's something alien." Something alien. The moving walkway carried them past endless, large cargo bays. They were going forward to join Barnes and Ted and Edmonds and to see their alien discovery. "Why would anyone send a spaceship through a black hole?" Beth asked.
"Because of gravity," Harry said. "You see, black holes have so much gravity they distort space and time incredibly. You remember how Ted was saying that planets and stars make dents in the fabric of space-time? Well, black holes make tears in the fabric. And some people think it's possible to fly through those tears into another universe, or another part of our universe, or to another time."
"Another time?"
"That's the idea," Harry said. "Are you people coming?" Barnes's tinny voice on the monitor.
"In transit now," Beth said, glowering at the screen.
"He can't see you," Norman said.
"I don't care."
They rode past more cargo areas. Harry said, "I can't wait to see Ted's face when we tell him." Finally, they reached the end of the walkway. They passed through a midsection of struts and girders and entered a large forward room which they had previously seen on the monitor. With ceilings nearly 100 feet high, it was enormous. "You could put a 6-story building in this room," Norman thought. Looking up, he saw a hazy mist with fog.
"What's that?"
"That's a cloud," Barnes said, shaking his head. "The room is so big it apparently has its own weather. Maybe it even rains in here sometimes." The room was filled with machinery on an immense scale. At first glance, it looked like oversized earth-moving machinery, except it was brightly painted in primary colors, glistening with oil. Then Norman began to notice individual features. There were giant claw hands, enormously powerful arms, moving gear wheels, and an array of buckets and receptacles. He realized suddenly he was looking at something very similar to the grippers and claws mounted on the front end of the Charon V submersible he had ridden down on the day before. Was it the day before? Or was it still the same day?
Which day?
Was this July 4th? How long had they been down here?
"If you look carefully," Barnes was saying, "you can see that some of these devices appear to be large-scale weapons. Others, like that long extensor arm, the various attachments to pick things up, in effect make this ship a gigantic robot."
"A robot? No kidding," Beth said.
"I guess it would have been appropriate for a robot to open it after all," Ted said thoughtfully.
"Maybe even fitting."
"Snug fitting," Beth said.
"Pipe fitting," Norman said.
"Sort of robot to robot, you mean?" Harry said. "Sort of a meeting of the threads and treads."
"Hey," Ted said. "I don't make fun of your comments, even when they're stupid."
"I wasn't aware they ever were," Harry said.
"You say foolish things sometimes. Thoughtless."
"Children," Barnes said. "Can we get back to the business at hand?"
"Point it out the next time, Ted."
"I will."
I'll be glad to know when I say something foolish. No problem. Something you consider foolish.
Tell you what, Barnes said to Norman, when we go back to the surface, let's leave these two down here.
Surely you can't think of going back now,
Ted said. We've already voted.
But that was before we found the object.
Where is the object? Harry said.
Over here, Harry, Ted said with a wicked grin. Let's see what your fabled powers of deduction make of this.
They walked deeper into the room, moving among the giant hands and claws, and they saw, nestled in the padded claw of one hand, a large, perfectly polished silver sphere, about 30 feet in diameter. The sphere had no markings or features of any kind. They moved around the sphere, seeing themselves reflected in the polished metal. Norman noticed an odd, shifting iridescence, faint rainbow hues of blue and red gleaming in the metal.
It looks like an oversized ball bearing, Harry said.
Keep walking, smart guy.
On the far side, they discovered a series of deep, convoluted grooves cut in an intricate pattern into the surface of the sphere. The pattern was arresting, though Norman could not immediately say why. The pattern wasn't geometric, and it wasn't amorphous or organic either. It was hard to say what it was. Norman had never seen anything like it, and as he continued to look at it, he felt increasingly certain this was a pattern never found on Earth, never created by any man, never conceived by a human imagination. Ted and Barnes were right, he felt sure of it. This sphere was something alien. Priorities.
Huh,
Harry said after staring in silence for a long time.
I'm sure you'll want to get back to us on this, Ted said. About where it came from and so on.
Actually, I know where it came from. And he told Ted about the star record and the black hole.
Actually, Ted said, I suspected that this ship was made to travel through a black hole for some time.
Did you? What was your first clue?
The heavy radiation shielding.
Harry nodded.
That's true.
You probably guessed the significance of that before I did. He smiled, but you didn't tell anybody.
Hey, Ted said, there's no question about it. I was the one who proposed the black hole first.
You did?
Yes, no question at all. Remember in the conference room? I was explaining to Norman about space-time, and I started to do the calculations for the black hole, and then you joined in. Norman, you remember that. I proposed it first.
Norman said, that's true. You had the idea.
Harry grinned.
I didn't feel that was a proposal. I thought it was more like a guess.
Or a speculation. Harry, Ted said, you are rewriting history. There are witnesses.
Since you're so far ahead of everybody else, Harry said, how about telling us your proposals for the nature of this object?
With pleasure, Ted said.
This object is a burnished sphere approximately 10 meters in diameter, not solid, and composed of a dense metal alloy of an as-yet-unknown nature. The cabalistic markings on this side, these grooves are what you're calling cabalistic.
Do you mind if I finish?
The cabalistic markings on this side clearly suggest artistic or religious ornamentation, evoking a ceremonial quality. This indicates the object has significance to whoever made it.
I think we can be sure that's true.
Personally, I believe that this sphere is intended as a form of contact with us, visitors from another star, another solar system. It is, if you will, a greeting, a message, or a trophy, a proof that a higher form of life exists in the universe.
All well and good and beside the point, Harry said. What does it do?
I'm not sure it does anything. I think it just is. It is what it is.
Very zen.
Well, what's your idea?
Let's review what we know, Harry said, as opposed to what we imagine in a flight of fancy.
This is a spacecraft from the future, built with all sorts of materials and technology we haven't developed yet, although we are about to develop them.
This ship was sent by our descendants through a black hole and into another universe, or another part of our universe.
Yes.
This spacecraft is unmanned, but equipped with robot arms which are clearly designed to pick up things that it finds. So we can think of this ship as a huge version of the unmanned Mariner spacecraft that we sent in the 1970s to Mars to look for life there. This spacecraft from the future is much bigger and more complicated, but it's essentially the same sort of machine. It's a probe.
Yes.
So the probe goes into another universe, where it comes upon this sphere. Presumably it finds the sphere floating in space, or perhaps the sphere is sent out to meet the spacecraft.
Right, it said. Sent out to meet it, as an emissary. That's what I think.
In any case, our robot spacecraft, according to whatever built-in criteria it has, decides that this sphere is interesting. It automatically grabs the sphere in its big claw hand here, draws it inside the ship, and brings it home. Except in going home, it goes too far. It goes into the past.
It's past, Harry said. Our present.
Right.
Barnes snorted impatiently. Fine, so this spacecraft goes out and picks up a silver alien sphere and brings it back. Get to the point. What is this sphere?
Harry walked forward to the sphere, pressed his ear against the metal, and rapped it with his knuckles. He touched the grooves, his hands disappearing in the deep indentations.
The sphere was so highly polished, Norman could see Harry's face distorted in the curve of the metal.
Yes, as I suspected, these cabalistic markings, as you call them, are not decorative at all. They have another purpose entirely, to conceal a small break in the surface of the sphere. Thus they represent a door.
Harry stepped back.
What is the sphere?
I'll tell you what I think, Harry said. I think this sphere is a hollow container. I think there's something inside, and I think it scares the hell out of me.
First evaluation.
No, Mr. Secretary, Barnes said into the phone. We're pretty sure it is an alien artifact. There doesn't seem to be any question about that.
He glanced at Norman, sitting across the room.
Yes, sir, Barnes said. Very damn exciting.
They were back in the habitat, and Barnes had immediately called Washington. He was trying to delay their return to the surface.
Not yet. We haven't opened it.
Well, we haven't been able to open it. The door is a weird shape, and it's very finely milled.
No, you couldn't wedge anything in the crack.
He looked at Norman, rolled his eyes.
No, we tried that, too. There don't seem to be any exterior controls.
No, no message on the outside.
No, no labels either.
All it is a highly polished sphere with some convoluted grooves on one side.
What?
Blast it open?
Norman turned away. He was in D cylinder in the communications section run by Tina Chan. She was adjusting a dozen monitors with her usual calm.
Norman said, You seem like the most relaxed person here.
She smiled. Just inscrutable, sir.
Is that it?
It must be, sir, she said, adjusting the vertical gain on one rolling monitor. The screen showed the polished sphere.
Because I feel my heart pounding, sir. What do you think is inside that thing?
I haven't any idea, Norman said.
Do you think there's an alien inside? You know, some kind of a living creature?
Maybe.
And we're trying to open it up?
Maybe we shouldn't let it out, whatever is in there.
Aren't you curious? Norman said.
Not that curious, sir.
I don't see how blasting would work,
Barnes was saying on the phone.
Yes, we have SMTMPs, yes. Oh, different sizes. But I don't think we can blast the sucker open.
No.
Well, if you saw it, you'd understand. The thing is perfectly made. Perfect.
Tina adjusted the second monitor. They had two views of the sphere, and soon there would be a third. Edmonds was setting up cameras to watch the sphere. That had been one of Harry's suggestions. Harry had said, Monitor it. Maybe it does something from time to time. Has some activity. On the screen, he saw the network of wires that had been attached to the sphere. They had a full array of passive sensors. Sound
and the full electromagnetic spectrum from infrared to gamma and X-rays. The readouts on the sensors were displayed on a bank of instruments to the left. Harry came in. Getting anything yet?
Tina shook her head. So far, nothing.
Has Ted come back?
No, Norman said. Ted's still there.
Ted had remained behind in the cargo bay, ostensibly to help Edmund set up the cameras. But in fact, they knew he would try to open the sphere. They saw Ted now on the second monitor, probing the grooves, touching, pushing.
Harry smiled.
He hasn't got a prayer.
Norman said, Harry, remember when we were in the flight deck and you said you wanted to make out your will because something was missing?
Oh, that, Harry said.
Forget it. That's irrelevant now.
Barnes was saying, No, Mr. Secretary, raising it to the surface would be just about impossible.
Well, sir, it is presently located inside a cargo bay half a mile inside the ship, and the ship is buried under 30 feet of coral, and the sphere itself is a good 30 feet across. It's the size of a small house.
I just wonder what's in the house, Tina said.
On the monitor, Ted kicked the sphere in frustration.
Not a prayer, Harry said again. He'll never get it open.
Beth came in. How are we going to open it?
Harry said, How?
Harry stared thoughtfully at the sphere, gleaming on the monitor. There was a long silence.
Maybe we can't.
We can't open it? You mean not ever?
That's one possibility.
Norman laughed. Ted would kill himself.
Barnes was saying, Well, Mr. Secretary, if you wanted to commit the necessary Navy resources to do a full-scale salvage from 1,000 feet, we might be able to undertake it starting 6 months from now when we were assured of a month of good surface weather in this region.
Yes, it's winter in the South Pacific now.
Yes.
Beth said, I can see it now. At great expense, the Navy brings a mysterious alien sphere to the surface. It is transported to a top-secret government installation in Omaha. Experts from every branch come and try to open it.
Nobody can.
Like Excalibur, Norman said.
Beth said, As time goes by, they try stronger and stronger methods. Eventually, they try to blow it open with a small nuclear device, and still nothing. Finally, nobody has any more ideas. The sphere sits there. Decades go by. The sphere is never opened.
She shook her head.
One great frustration for mankind.
Norman said to Harry, Do you really think that had happened, that we'd never get it open?
Harry said, Never is a long time.
No, sir, Barnes was saying. Given this new development, we'll stay down to the last minute. Weather topside is holding at least 6 more hours,
yes, sir, from the NetSat reports.
Well, I have to rely on that judgment.
Yes, sir.
Hourly, yes, sir.
He hung up, turned to the group.
Okay, we have authorization to stay down 6 to 12 hours more, as long as the weather holds. Let's try to open that sphere in the time remaining.
Ted's working on it now, Harry said. On the video monitor, they saw Ted Fielding slap the polished sphere with his hand and shout, Open! Open, Sesame! Open up, you son of a bitch!
The sphere did not respond.
The anthropomorphic problem. Seriously, Norman said. I think somebody has to ask the question, should we consider not opening it up?
Why? Barnes said.
Listen, I just got off the phone.
I know, Norman said.
But maybe we should think twice about this. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Tina nodding vigorously. Harry looked skeptical. Beth rubbed her eyes, sleepy.
Are you afraid, or do you have a substantive argument?
Barnes said. I have the feeling, Harry said, that Norman's about to quote from his own work.
Well, yes, Norman admitted, and I did put this in my report. In his report, he had called it the anthropomorphic problem. Basically, the problem was that everybody who had ever thought or written about extraterrestrial life imagined that life as essentially human. Even if the extraterrestrial life didn't look human, if it was a reptile or a big insect or an intelligent crystal, it still acted in a human way.
You're talking about the movies, Barnes said.
I'm talking about research papers, too.
Every conception of extraterrestrial life, whether by a movie maker or a university professor, has been basically human, assuming human values, human understanding, human ways of approaching a humanly understandable universe, and generally a human appearance, two eyes, a nose, a mouth, and so on. So, Norman said, that's obviously nonsense. For one thing, there's enough variation in human behavior to make understanding just within our own species very troublesome. The differences between, say, Americans and Japanese are very great. Americans and Japanese don't really look at the world the same way at all. Yes, yes, Barnes said impatiently. We all know the Japanese are different. And when you come to a new life form, the differences may be literally incomprehensible. The values and ethics of this new form of life may be utterly different. You mean it may not believe in the sanctity of life, or thou shalt not kill, Barnes said, still impatient. No, Norman said. I mean that this creature may not be able to be killed, and so it may have no concept of killing in the first place. Barnes stopped. This creature may not be able to be killed? Norman nodded. As someone once said, you can't break the arms of a creature that has no arms. It can't be killed. You mean it's immortal? I don't know, Norman said. That's the point. I mean, Jesus, a thing that couldn't be killed, Barnes said. How would we kill it? He bit his lip. I wouldn't like to open that sphere and release a thing that couldn't be killed. Harry laughed. No promotions for that one, Hal. Barnes looked at the monitors, showing several views of the polished sphere. Finally, he said, No, that's ridiculous. No living thing is immortal. Am I right, Beth? Actually, no, Beth said. You could argue that certain living creatures on our own planet are immortal. For example, single-celled organisms like bacteria and yeasts are apparently capable of living indefinitely. Yeasts, Barnes snorted. We're not talking about yeasts. And to all intents and purposes, a virus could be considered immortal. A virus? Barnes sat down in a chair. He hadn't considered a virus. But how likely is it, really, Harry? I think, Harry said, that the possibilities go far beyond what we've mentioned so far. We've only considered three-dimensional creatures of the kind that exist in our three-dimensional universe, or to be more precise, the universe that we perceive as having three dimensions. Some people think our universe has 9 or 11 dimensions. Barnes looked tired. Except the other 6 dimensions are very small, so we don't notice them. Barnes rubbed his eyes. Therefore, this creature, Harry continued, may be multidimensional so that it literally does not exist, at least not entirely, in our usual 3 dimensions. To take the simplest case, if it were a 4-dimensional creature, we would only see part of it at any time, because most of the creature would exist in the 4th dimension. That would obviously make it difficult to kill. And if it were a 5-dimensional creature... Just a minute. Why haven't any of you mentioned this before?
We thought you knew, Harry said.
Knew about 5-dimensional creatures that can't be killed? Nobody said a word to me. He shook his head. Opening this sphere could be incredibly dangerous.
It could, yes.
What we have here is... We have Pandora's box.
That's right.
Well... Barnes said. Let's consider worst cases. What's the worst case for what we might find?
Beth said, I think that's clear.
Irrespective of whether it's a multidimensional creature or a virus or whatever, irrespective of whether it shares our morals or has no morals at all, the worst case is that it hits us below the belt.
Meaning?
Meaning that it behaves in a way that interferes with our basic life mechanisms. A good example is the AIDS virus. The reason why AIDS is so dangerous is not that it's new. We get new viruses every year, every week, and all viruses work in the same way. They attack cells and convert the machinery of the cells to make more viruses. What makes the AIDS virus dangerous is it attacks the specific cells that we use to defend against viruses. AIDS interferes with our basic defense mechanism, and we have no defense against it.
Well, Barnes said,
if this sphere contains a creature that interferes with our basic mechanisms, what would that creature be like? It could breathe in air and exhale cyanide gas. Beth said. It could excrete radioactive waste, Harry said.
It could disrupt our brain waves, Norman said, interfere with our ability to think.
Or, Beth said, it might merely disrupt cardiac conduction, stop our hearts from beating.
It might produce a sound vibration that would resonate in our skeletal system and shatter our bones, Harry said.
He smiled at the others. I rather like that one.
Clever, Beth said. But, as usual, we're only thinking of ourselves. The creature might do nothing directly harmful to us at all.
Ah, Barnes said.
It might simply exhale a toxin that kills chloroplasts, so the plants could no longer convert sunlight. Then all the plants on Earth would die, and consequently all life on Earth would die.
Ah, Barnes said.
You see, Norman said, at first I thought the anthropomorphic problem, the fact that we can only conceive of extraterrestrial life as basically human, I thought it was a failure of imagination. Man is man. All he knows is man. And all he can think of is what he knows. Yet, as you can see, that's not true. We can think of plenty of other things, but we don't. So there must be another reason why we only conceive of extraterrestrials as humans. And I think the answer is that we are, in reality, terribly frail animals. And we don't like to be reminded of how frail we are, how delicate the balances are inside our own bodies, how short our stay on Earth, and how easily it is ended. So we imagine other life forms as being like us. So we don't have to think of the real threat, the terrifying threat they may represent, without ever intending to.
There was a silence.
Of course, we mustn't forget another possibility, Barnes said. It may be that the sphere contains some extraordinary benefit to us. Some wondrous new knowledge, some astonishing new idea or new technology which will improve the condition of mankind beyond our wildest dreams. Although the chances are, Harry said, that there won't be any new idea that is useful to us.
Why? Barnes said. Well, let's say that the aliens are 1,000 years ahead of us, just as we are relative to, say, medieval Europe. Suppose you went back to medieval Europe with a television set. There wouldn't be any place to plug it in.
Barnes stared from one to another for a long time.
I'm sorry, he said. This is too great a responsibility for me. I can't make the decision to open it up. I have to call Washington on this.
Ted won't be happy, Harry said.
The hell with Ted, Barnes said. I'm going to give this to the president. Until we hear from him, I don't want anybody trying to open that sphere.
Barnes called for a 2-hour rest period, and Harry went to his quarters to sleep. Beth announced that she was going off to sleep, too, but she remained at the monitor station with Tina Chan and Norman. Chan's station had comfortable chairs with high backs, and Beth swiveled in the chair, swinging her legs back and forth. She played with her hair, making little ringlets by her ear, and she stared into space.
Tired, Norman thought.
We're all tired. He watched Tina, who moved smoothly and continuously, adjusting the monitors, checking the sensor inputs, changing the videotapes on the bank of VCRs, tense, alert. Because Edmonds was in the spaceship with Ted, Tina had to look after the recording units as well as her own communications console. The Navy woman didn't seem to be as tired as they were, but then she hadn't been inside the spaceship. To her, that spaceship was something she saw on the monitors, a TV show, an abstraction. Tina hadn't been confronted face to face with the reality of the new environment, the exhausting mental struggle to understand what was going on, what it all meant.
You look tired, sir, Tina said.
Yes, we're all tired. It's the atmosphere, she said, breathing the heliox.
So much for psychological explanations, Norman thought.
Tina said, the density of the air down here has a real effect. We're at 30 atmospheres. If we were breathing regular air at this pressure, it would be almost as thick as a liquid. Heliox is lighter, but it's far denser than what we're used to. You don't realize it, but it's tiring just to breathe, to move your lungs.
But you aren't tired.
Oh, I'm used to it. I've been in saturated environments before.
Is that right?
Where?
I really can't say, Dr. Johnson.
Navy operation?
She smiled. I am not supposed to talk about it.
Is that your inscrutable smile?
I hope so, sir, but don't you think you ought to try and sleep?
He nodded. Probably.
Norman considered going to sleep, but the prospect of his damp bunk was unappealing. Instead, he went down to the galley, hoping to find one of Rose Levy's desserts. Levy was not there, but there was some coconut cake under a plastic dome. He found a plate, cut a slice, and took it over to one of the portholes. But it was black outside the porthole. The grid lights were turned off, the divers gone. He saw lights in the portholes of DH-7, the diver's habitat, located a few dozen yards away. The divers must be getting ready to go back to the surface. Or perhaps they had already gone. In the porthole, he saw his own face reflected. The face looked tired and old. This is no place for a 53-year-old man, he said, watching his reflection. As he looked out, he saw some moving lights in the distance, then a flash of yellow. One of the mini-subs pulled up under a cylinder at DH-7. Moments later, a second sub arrived to dock alongside it. The lights on the first sub went out. After a short time, the second sub pulled away into the black water. The first sub was left behind. What's going on? He wondered. But he was aware he didn't really care. He was too tired. He was more interested in what the cake would taste like. And looked down. The cake was eaten. Only a few crumbs remained.
Tired, he thought.
Very tired. He put his feet up on the coffee table and put his head back against the cool padding of the wall. He must have fallen asleep for a while because he awoke disoriented in darkness. He sat up and immediately the lights came on. He saw he was still in the galley. Barnes had warned him about that, the way the habitat adjusted to the presence of people. Apparently the motion sensors stopped registering you if you fell asleep and automatically shut off the room lights. Then when you awoke and moved, the lights came back. He wondered if the lights would stay on if you snored. Who had designed all this, he wondered. Had the engineers and designers working on the Navy habitat taken snoring into account? Was there a snore sensor? More cake. He got up and walked across to the galley kitchen. Several pieces of cake were now missing. Had he eaten them? He wasn't sure. Couldn't remember. A lot of videotapes, Beth said. Norman turned around.
Yes, Tina said.
We are recording everything that goes on in this habitat as well as the other ship. It'll be a lot of material. There was a monitor mounted just above his head. It showed Beth and Tina upstairs at the communications console. They were eating cake. He thought, so that was where the cake had gone. Every 12 hours, the tapes are transferred to the submarine, Tina said.
What for? Beth said.
That's so if anything happens down here, the submarine will automatically go to the surface.
Oh, great, Beth said. I won't think about that too much.
Where is Dr. Fielding now?
Tina said.
He gave up on the sphere and went into the main flight deck with Edmonds.
Norman watched the monitor. Tina had stepped out of view. Beth sat with her back to the monitor, eating the cake. On the monitor behind Beth, he could clearly see the gleaming sphere.
Monitors showing monitors, he thought. The Navy people who eventually review this stuff are going to go crazy.
Tina said, Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?
Beth chewed her cake.
Maybe, she said.
I don't know.
And to Norman's horror, he saw on the monitor, behind Beth, that the door of the sphere was sliding silently open, revealing blackness inside.
Open. They must have thought he was crazy, running through the locked D cylinder and stumbling up the narrow stairs to the upper level, shouting, It's open! It's open! He came to the communications console just as Beth was wiping the last crumbs of coconut from her lips. She set down her fork.
What's open?
The sphere! Beth spun in her chair. Tina ran over from the bank of VCRs. They both looked at the monitor behind Beth. There was an awkward silence.
Looks closed to me, Norman.
It was open.
I saw it.
He told them about watching in the galley on the monitor. It was just a few seconds ago, and the sphere definitely opened. It must have closed again while I was on my way here.
Are you sure?
That's a pretty small monitor in the galley.
I saw it, Norman said.
Replay it if you don't believe me.
Good idea, Tina said, and she went to